Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards Program, celebrating 25 years of recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The federal government won't be pre-approving voting laws in Florida after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling this week, and minority advocates are protesting.
It's a direct attack on the black vote.
It's clear that these policies are aimed at making it harder to vote for people of color.
In Florida, discrimination does not live in the past.
Also tonight, proponents of marriage equality in Florida are celebrating Wednesday's Supreme Court rulings but see plenty of work ahead.
This ruling says that federal rights should be bestowed, but the reality is that it'll be much more complicated than that.
We'll also get the latest on the George Zimmerman trial, hear about the rise of Florida's refugee population, and find out if the famed Florida A&M University marching band will once again be wowing halftime audiences before too long. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Before we get into the other news of the week, the second-degree murder trial of George Zimmerman continued today in Sanford. A witness told jurors that he saw the shooting victim, Trayvon Martin, on top of George Zimmerman during the deadly scuffle. As Amy Green with member station WMFE in Orlando reports, neighbor John Good testified Zimmerman was the one calling for help.
John Good said he went outside when he heard the tussle. He saw someone dressed in dark clothing on top of someone else in light or red clothing. Martin wore a gray hoodie, Zimmerman a red jacket. Defense attorney Mark O'Mara asked Good to explain what he saw.
The person who you now know to be Trayvon Martin was on top, correct?
Correct.
And he was the one who was raining blows down on the person on the bottom, George Zimmerman, right?
That's what it looked like.
Good said the teen straddled Zimmerman. He believes it was Zimmerman crying for help because of the position of the two people and the way the sound carried. Prosecutors say Zimmerman profiled, followed, and murdered Martin, but Zimmerman says he was attacked and fired in self-defense. I'm Amy Green in Sanford.
Florida minority rights groups are joining a national campaign calling for a federal constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to vote. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the move comes in the wake of a U.S. Supreme Court decision striking down part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
The Supreme Court struck down the part of the Voting Rights Act requiring the federal Justice Department to pre-approve voting laws in several mostly southern counties and states, including five counties in Florida. That didn't sit well with minority rights activists.
It's a direct attack on the black vote.
It's clear that these policies are aimed at making it harder to vote for people of color.
In Florida, discrimination does not live in the past.
That's North Carolina NAACP President William Barber. Judith Brown Dianis, who directs the Washington, D.C.-based civil rights group The Advancement Project, and Gihan Pereira, executive director of the group Florida New Majority. Pereira says the Voting Rights Act, including the section the court invalidated, gave groups like his the leverage to be able to challenge Florida's controversial new voting laws in the run-up to the 2012 election.
The five counties covered by Section 5 were the only counties in the state where groups like ours could still register voters uninhibited by the onerous limitations placed on voting rights by Florida's House Bill 1355.
The Florida law outlawed third-party groups from registering voters and reduced the number of early voting days, including shutting polls the Sunday before the election. Advocates say all of that suppresses minority turnout. After legal battles last year, third-party groups were allowed to continue voter registration drives, and the legislature restored early voting days. But in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled it's unconstitutional to review only some regions, saying the standard should be the same for all states. Writing for the court majority, Chief Justice John Roberts says federal preclearance for voting laws has lost its relevance nearly 50 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed. Chris Cate, a spokesman for the Florida State Department, says the ruling will make things easier.
It's going to be positive for Florida because all counties are going to be treated equally. So rather than five counties needing to go through this extra process, laws will be able to be implemented on the date that the bill that was signed into law goes into effect.
But Florida A&M University law professor Patricia Broussard disagrees. She says the law hasn't lost its relevance in Florida. Broussard had filed a brief in the case urging the Supreme Court to uphold all sections of the Voting Rights Act, but she says the ruling may be a catalyst for change.
You cannot spread democracy. You cannot argue that our way is the right way to do it when you suppress the very right that makes this country great. So I think that you will see a group coalesce that will transcend race, class, and all kind of status to say, we've got to get this right.
And coalesce, they have. The Florida New Majority and Florida NAACP have joined a national campaign called Free to Vote. They're collecting petition signatures urging Congress to pass a federal constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to vote. To become law, amendments need approval from two-thirds of Congress and ratification by 38 states. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
The U.S. Supreme Court's decisions on marriage equality this week will have a major impact at the federal level, but the impact on Florida is less clear. As Nick Evans reports, the state must still grapple with how same-sex couples married in another state will access federal benefits in Florida.
Supporters of marriage equality in Tallahassee had a standing date at the state capitol Wednesday, regardless of the outcome of the day's rulings.
We started organizing it weeks ago. We didn't know whether we were going to be celebrating or whether going to be crying and mourning.
That's Stephen Hall, chair of Tallahassee's Family Tree Community Center. He was among a group of demonstrators that took over the capitol steps, holding signs and chanting slogans in support of marriage equality. Away from the Capitol, gay marriage advocates were a bit more cautious.
Well, we didn't get a grand slam, but we certainly got something to be proud of.
That's Orlando Democratic State Representative Linda Stewart, who says more battles lie ahead.
We should all be very happy with the DOMA decision, but we do have to keep working. This is not the end for Florida, that's for sure.
Another Orlando State Representative, Democrat Joe Saunders, says it's too soon to say how federal benefits will be administered in states that don't recognize same-sex marriages.
This ruling says that federal rights should be bestowed. But the reality is that it'll be much more complicated than that. There's a lot of question marks right now about which benefits that come from the federal government really will be applicable to married couples in Florida.
Many federal agencies rely on state governments to determine the validity of marriages. Saunders says Florida's posture on gay marriage could have serious detrimental effects.
I think there are economic implications of that. We are going to be seeing families leave. We're going to have a hard time getting businesses, small and large, to come because their employees won't feel protected here or respected here. And we'll lose their tax dollars, we'll lose their small businesses, and we'll lose the jobs that they inevitably create.
Oddly enough, some Floridians who favor traditional marriage statutes saw the ruling as a victory, too.
My name is John Stemberger. I'm president and general counsel of the Florida Family Policy Council.
Stemberger says the court's narrow ruling upholds state sovereignty.
It is a mixed bag, both good news and bad news from our perspective. Good news is that in Florida, our constitutional amendment, which defines marriage, still stands. So the court did respect states' rights, and it did not force this issue, allowing states to define marriage.
If supporters of marriage equality wish to change Florida's marriage laws, they'll have to contend with that constitutional amendment. To change the state's constitution, 60% of Florida voters would have to overturn it at the polls. But first, it needs to make it to the ballot. Groups such as Equality Florida are already collecting signatures in hope of collecting the more than 680,000 necessary for the referendum to appear on the 2014 ballot. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report,
Governor Rick Scott signs a bill into law, and opponents immediately sue to overturn it, saying some pivotal parts violate the Florida Constitution.
Regardless of what the bill says, only the governor can decide whether or when to sign a death warrant.
Is Florida becoming a land of refugees?
We're the largest resettlement state in the country, and we've been doing this for a very long time.
And Florida's most famous collegiate marching band is no longer under suspension and could soon be back on the field.
So I'm thinking in time, the culture of the band will change, and hopefully when that changes, the band will be what it should be. Because, you know, this band is really important to the university and, of course, the state of Florida and the city of Tallahassee.
Attorney General Pam Bondi warning Floridians to be careful about companies that claim window film provides protection from hurricane-force winds. Bondi's office has entered 8 settlement agreements with companies that sell window film, noting that the Florida Building Commission has not approved the material as a form of hurricane protection. She's advising consumers to contact the Better Business Bureau before buying window film for that purpose, and she says her agency is looking into a number of businesses that offer the window covering as a storm protection. She says Florida's senior citizens are most at risk to fall for the scams. A lawsuit filed this week asked the Florida Supreme Court to block a new law supporters say would speed up death penalty cases. Jessica Palumbo is back to tell us the state agency that represents death row inmates after direct appeals have been exhausted wants the Timely Justice Act to not take effect this coming Monday.
Governor Rick Scott signed the Timely Justice Act earlier this month. The law would impose strict time limits for parts of the death penalty process and require automatic death warrants at a certain stage. Lawyer Chance Meyer is with the Capital Collateral Regional Council, which filed the suit on behalf of 170 death row inmates.
We certainly understand the impulse for the need for swift justice, but the fact is the problem isn't a lack of speed in the process, it's a lack of process in the process. That's why we've had so many exonerations.
Florida leads all other states for the number of people convicted to death row and later exonerated. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
The Timely Justice Act deals with the extremely complex capital punishment process. Lynn Hatter reports critics of the act are asking not only whether it's morally acceptable, but whether it's even enforceable.
Outside Florida's historic Capitol building, one man stands with a plain black and white sign. Kurt Wadsworth is a 27-year-old University of West Florida student. He says he was relatively apolitical until he began reading news reports blasting the state's so-called Timely Justice Act.
So they wanted to call it justice. But luckily, a great man walked this earth, and his name was Martin Luther King, and he defined justice as not hurting people. So they may want to call it justice, but why know, and we know in our hearts, that justice is not hurting people.
Opponents say the new law could lead innocent people on death row to be executed before evidence comes to light that could free them. The law's supporters say it's aimed at streamlining the death penalty process. One of the biggest issues with the law is a provision giving the governor 30 days to sign a death warrant after all appeals have been exhausted and he's decided whether to grant clemency. But Tallahassee attorney Mark Schlackman says there's a catch.
Regardless of what the legislature might pass, it cannot curtail the governor's clemency authority as vested in the Constitution. So regardless of what the bill says, only the governor can decide whether or when to sign a death warrant.
Schlackman, who serves on a commission aimed at freeing wrongfully convicted people, sides with Governor Rick Scott. In recent weeks, Scott has argued the Timely Justice Act won't speed up executions in Florida, but others disagree.
The Timely Justice Act could potentially result in a flood of death warrants.
Suzanne Keffer is with the State Commission on Capital Cases, a group of lawyers who litigate such issues. Keffer points to roughly 90 death penalty cases expected to reach the governor after the start of July. The Timely Justice Act has also been the topic of scathing editorials around the state, and it's even been discussed on national outlets like Slate Magazine. The popular NPR program This American Life recently included a feature on the law. And all this discussion has some people wondering why Florida lawmakers approved the legislation in the first place. Outside Florida's historic Capitol building, an elderly woman walks up to join Kurt Wadsworth. Agnes Fury is against the death penalty, even though her daughter and her grandson were murdered. The man convicted of the crime pled guilty to capital murder to avoid the death penalty, and Fury says it was a relief.
I wanted him convicted. I wanted him to be accountable for what he did, but I never wanted to kill him, and I never wanted the state to kill him in my name.
During the legislature's debate on the Timely Justice Act, its biggest champion was Panhandle Republican Representative Matt Gaetz. Gaetz said the measure was aimed at keeping death penalty cases from wallowing in the system for years.
Only God can judge, but we can sure set up the meeting.
But that kind of language, says Fury, doesn't do anyone any good. For her, Gaetz' words don't resonate. But she says she knows there are others who feel differently.
Every family is different. Some families, their first impulse is to kill the bastard. And I can understand that. I just can't join it. Everybody has to come reach their own conclusions when they're faced with that decision.
There are more than 400 people on death row in Florida. Florida's Timely Justice Act comes at a time when death penalty laws are on the decline. More than 16 states have abolished their death penalty or are no longer enforcing it. But efforts to get rid of the death penalty in Florida have failed in previous years. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
World Refugee Day is this month, and it seems the number of refugees, both worldwide and here in Florida, is growing. The United Nations pegs the total number of people in what it calls situations of displacement at 42 million. In Florida, meanwhile, Regan McCarthy reports officials are working two sides of the refugee issue. They're thanking those who help the refugees who wind up in Florida. They're also trying to make more Floridians aware of their refugee neighbors.
Last year, almost 29,000 new refugees arrived in the state of Florida. They came from nearly 100 countries and received services from the Florida Department of Children and Families. The department's responsible for helping refugees using funds from the federal government. That help comes in the form of job placement, child care, health care, and education. And this month, the state is recognizing World Refugee Day. Vicki Abrams is with the Department of Children and Families.
Well, one of the things that we want to do is bring awareness that there are people who are refugees living in our community.
Experts say only about 10% of the refugees in the world will find new homes, and about two-thirds of those will come to the U.S. Nationally, most refugees are coming from Afghanistan, Somalia, Iraq, Syria, and Sudan. The majority of the refugees who come to Florida are from South American countries, like Angel Trejo from Cuba. He arrived in Florida with his sister and teenage brother in 1961.
Castro took over in 1959. There were executions, persecutions, freedom of speech was totally gone, and my parents made the decision to get us out of the country.
But Trejo's father wasn't able to get a visa to leave right away because he was a physician. Trejo tears up a little as he says he can't imagine what his parents went through when they decided to send their children to the United States and stay behind themselves. But almost a year later, Trejo's parents did make it to the U.S.
When my father came to this country, and this is the amazing thing, he was 62 years old. So he had to start his whole practice over again. He took his board when he was 62, passed them again, and got his license as a physician.
And Trejo says he's had some experience more recently. Not long ago, he helped a cousin come to Florida from Cuba by way of Mexico. Department of Children and Families Deputy Director of Refugee Services, Patty Grogan, says that's one difference between an immigrant and a refugee. Typically, refugees have to stop in another country before being settled in a third. And she says they're also usually pre-approved before they arrive.
Refugees are also eligible for a very limited time of public benefits to help them get established. Because you can understand if somebody's in a refugee camp with nothing but the clothes on their back, coming then to the United States, they have to have some assistance to begin.
And Grogan says Florida is a pretty good place for a refugee to start over.
We're the largest resettlement state in the country, and we've been doing this for a very long time.
Florida has become a hub for refugees, in part because there are already communities across the state where incoming refugees can feel at home, as well as organizations that are ready to help. And Grogan says recognizing and growing that is a big part of what World Refugee Day is all about. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The state of Florida has moved a step closer to figuring out how to spread around the money it gets from the federal fines imposed on BP for the April 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster. Governor Rick Scott today signing a memorandum of understanding with a Gulf consortium to create the process for developing Florida's spending plan for its share of the money from the 2012 Resources and Ecosystem Sustainability, Tourist Opportunities, and Revived Economies of the Gulf Coast States Act. That's called the Restore Act for short. Development of a comprehensive and thoughtful plan would ensure that Florida moves towards environmental and economic recovery of the Gulf, said the governor in a statement. The June 2012 Act directs up to $21 billion from fines imposed on BP to the five Gulf Coast states. The consortium's made up of the 23 Gulf Coast counties. NASA is negotiating with Space Florida, that's the state's Aerospace Economic Development Agency, on the private maintenance and operation of the shuttle landing facility. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden and Robert Cabana, who's director of NASA's Kennedy Space Center, today announced the agreement to talk. Space Florida President Frank DiBello said in a release that the transaction could take months to finalize. The landing facility is the 15,000-foot-long, 300-foot-wide concrete runway that was built in 1976 for shuttle landings. The shuttle program, as you remember, ended back in 2011. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Lynn Hatter brought us a story a little while ago about the fabled Florida A&M University Marching 100 Band and speculation about it returning to action. This past week, the shackles of suspension imposed after the hazing death of a band drum major were removed from the legendary musical ensemble. Sasha Cordner reports, while some say the band is not ready to get back on the field, others say it's time for the university to move forward.
That's the Marching 100 in 2010 playing Rihanna's Please Don't Stop the Music. Kind of ironic given the events that would unfold a year later. After a hazing incident causing the death of former drum major Robert Champion in 2011, the music did stop.
I was more surprised than anything. I was surprised to hear that that had happened. I was just in shock, that's all. That's it.
Briani Lundy is a returning sophomore at Florida A&M who plays the piccolo. She played in the Marching 100 before the band was suspended and says she's relieved the suspension has been rescinded.
And I'm very, very happy that we are finally officially back, and I just can't wait to get back on the field, start practicing, and get it together.
Others, like Marching 100 Band Alumni Association President Victor Gaines, agree the band is ready. Gaines played in the band for 8 years, even serving as its head drum major.
I think it'll help the spirit. We were a university that was without music for a very long time, and you know, Music is a part of the universe, it's a part of us. And we like that. I mean, that's one of the things that keeps us upbeat, it keeps us going. And so hearing that again, I think would do wonders for the university, and as well as the admissions and the student population. I think we'll have more students coming in.
But the current band members won't go back to play for the same Marching 100. There are now limits on band practice hours and on the number of semesters someone can participate as an active member. And Interim University President Larry Robinson says that's reflective of the work the school has done to implement several anti-hazing procedures, including an anti-hazing campus tour given to potential in-state music students on campus forums and the hiring of a new hazing czar. Robinson says the tough new measures are already having an impact. He points to the suspensions of a number of campus groups because of suspected hazing activity.
And what that action shows that when it does, you know, present itself legitimately, we are taking swift and prompt actions. We all know that you have administrative infrastructure, policies and procedures, and then you got to get to the issue of changed behavior. Part of changing behavior is ensuring that people understand, those who might not quite get it, that we are very serious about it, and when and if it rears its head, we will take the appropriate action.
But not everyone believes the band should get back on the field. That includes Robert Champion's mother, Pam. In a press conference following the announcement Thursday, she questioned the motives behind FAMU officials lifting the band suspension, given its history.
They took the steps of putting the band on the field anyway for the dollar. So you really, there's no other way to think about the fact that you're putting dollar value over students' value, because this is a history.
The person in charge of rebuilding the band is Sylvester Young, the band's new director. A 66-year-old FAMU alum, he succeeds Julian White, who resigned along with then-FAMU president James Ammons in the wake of Champion's death.
The university has put a lot of things in place. There's a process we go through with every student. And so I'm thinking in time, the culture of the band will change. And hopefully when that changes, the band will be what it should be. Because, you know, this band is really important to this university and, of course, the state of Florida and the city of Tallahassee.
While it's uncertain whether the band will play in the fall, Interim President Robinson says he's leaving it up to band director Young to decide when the Marching 100 is ready for public performances. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our intern Nick Evans and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards Program, celebrating 25 years of recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.